to use not only his dexterity but also his intellect. With the total incorporation of the enterprise into the realm of monopoly, rational argumentation loses its force. It now bears the hallmarks of that sales talk in the service of which it was formerly used and which the victorious monopoly can dispense with. The distrust which peasants and children display for clip persons has always preserved the notion of that injustice which made language the servant of gain. Page 39. The muteness of men today is largely to be blamed on language which once was only too eloquent against them. Today, man needs factual knowledge, the automaton ability to react correctly, but he does not need the quiet consideration of diverse possibilities which presupposes the freedom and leisure of choice. The liberty which the market offered to the producers, consumers, and their multifold intermediaries, although it may have been abstract and deceptive, had at least permitted a certain range of deliberation. In the monopolistic apparatus, none possesses that time and range. Each has to respond quickly, to innervate promptly. Under totalitarian planning, men are dominated by the means of production even more than they were under the market system. Lack of efficiency is a capital offense. The brief period of spare time which still remains to men in their daily lives is now protected against waste. The danger that it will degenerate into artiosity, a state always despised so much by industry, is warded off. Since Descartes, philosophy was one great attempt to place itself as science in the service of the prevailing mode of production, an attempt opposed only by very few thinkers. With the abolition of otium and of the ego, no allow of thinking is left. The social atoms, so they may still yearn for liberation, have lost the speculative sense. In the good and bad connotation of that term, the outlook is dark for philosophy. Without otium, philosophical thought is impossible, cannot be conceived or understood. In such a state of affairs, the argumentative procedure of traditional philosophy appears as helpless and idle talk. At the last minute, phenomenology attempted paradoxically enough to elaborate a mode of thinking without disputation but positivism, in which this philosophy originated, became its heir. It removed thought from philosophy and reduced the latter to the technique of organizing by reproduction and abridgment. The matters of fact given in the world of sense, in positivism, reason sustains itself through self-liquidation. With the decline of the ego in its reflective reason, human relationship tends to a point wherein the rule of economy over all personal relationships, the universal control of commodities over the totality of life, turns into a new and naked form of command and obedience. No longer buttressed by small-scale property, the school and the home are losing their educational function of preparing men for life in society. Living and being prepared have become one and the same thing, just as with the military profession. In school, the hierarchy of sport and gymnastic triumphs over the classroom hierarchy, which has never been accepted wholeheartedly by children anyhow. Page 40. The disputed authority of the teacher decreases in favor of an unconditional and anonymous but ever-present authority whose demands now have preferences. This is the authority of the omnipotent standards of mass society. The quality which the child needs in this society are imposed upon him by the collectivity of the school class, and the latter is but a segment of the strictly organized society itself. The teacher has the choice of winning the pupil's favor even by harshness, if need be, or of being ridiculed. Compared with the skills which are required of the individual today, the curriculum possesses only a subordinate value. Children learn quickly to know the automobile and radio inside out. They are born with this knowledge, which is not essentially different from a knowledge of the most complicated machine, and they can do without science. School physics is obsolete in a twofold sense. It is equally remote from the mathematical consequences of relativity and quantum theory, which have long since passed beyond the limits of representation, and from the practical dexterity which alone matters to the pupil. The teacher cannot mediate between the realm of theory and practice, since the transition from practical observation to theory is no longer recognizable. The highest theory is still a mode of blind technique, as much as repair work is. Both are accomplished by sheer skill, the one in the study, the other in the shop. The difficulties which the theoretical physicist experiences when asked to cross from this mathematical synthesis of different conceptual realms to the world of object is about the same as the inability of the most skillful mechanic to cross from manipulation of the motor to the principle of its working. Physical knowledge is split into knowledge of handling and knowledge of fields, and this cleavage resulting from the division of labor affects the student's relation to knowledge as such. The exploration of meanings is replaced by an acquaintance with functions. The animistic carryovers of theory are weeded out, and this triumph at the same time implies a sacrificium intellectus. Technical practice can get along without physics, just as the film star can get along without an apprenticeship and the fascist statesman without learning. Education is no longer a process taking place between individuals, as it was when the father prepared his son to take over his property and the teacher supported him. Present-day education is directly carried out by society itself and takes place behind the back of the family. Childhood becomes a historical phenomenon. Christianity inaugurated the idea of childhood in its glorification of the weak, and the bourgeois family sometimes made the idea a reality. Page 41. During the Christian era of the Enlightenment, however, reason operated on the child as an external compulsion to self-preservation which crushed everything that could not defend itself. The sculpture and painting of the Middle Ages, which did not differentiate between physically and socially inferior beings, revealed the secret of the ordo and hierarchy. Namely, who could with impunity beat whom? Children who in the Christian world suffered the tortures of hell were in the Enlightenment world rewarded with the Christian heaven. Happiness shall be theirs because they have been chosen as the symbols of innocence. In his adoration of his children, the Enlightenment businessman of the 19th century could mourn his lost religion without becoming superstitious. Children symbolize the golden age as well as the promising future. The rationalistic society gave children legends and fairy tales so that they might mirror hope back to their disillusioned elders. The latter created the ideal of childhood in order to escape between the horns of sober knowledge and ideology from a dilemma which, in the face of ever-threatening social upheavals, they could not resolve. The child ideal reflected the truth within the lie that kept the underlying population in line, the utopia of eternal happiness. This utopia was the place of last resort for the religious ideals of those times in which the bourgeois themselves were still among the underlying. They can do without this utopia today. In monopolistic society, childhood and adolescence have become mere biological processes. Puberty is no longer a human crisis, for the child is grown up as soon as he can walk, and the grown-up in principle always remains the same. Development has ceased to exist. During the heyday of the family, the father represented the authority of society to the child, and puberty was the inevitable conflict between these two. Today, however, the child stands face to face with society at once, and the conflict is decided even before it arises. The world is so possessed by the power of what is and the efforts of adjustment to it, that the adolescent's rebellion, which once fought the father because his practices contradicted his own ideology, can no longer crop up. The process which hardens men by breaking down their individuality, a process consciously and planfully undertaken in the various camps of fascism, takes place tacitly and mechanically in them everywhere under mass culture. And at such an early age that when children come to consciousness, everything is settled. Since Freud, the relation between father and son has been reversed. Now the rapidly changing society, which passes its judgment upon the old, is represented not by the father, but by the child. The child, not the father, stands for reality.